originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm coming to you tonight from our Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you tuning into our website at www.horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to some 60 former riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit the website at www.pdjf.org. So get ready for this introduction. He's won the Preakness, the Belmont, and the Kentucky Derby 3 times each. 11 Breeders' Cup victories. He's won the Santa Anita Derby 9 times. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1997, also a recipient of the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award and Eclipse Award for Outstanding Jockey. He's an accomplished actor and racing analyst, and he keeps coming back with a knee replacement, a hip replacement, 5,084 wins, and over $250 million in earnings. It's an honor to introduce to you all jockey Gary Stevens. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Christina. How are you doing?
Doing just fine, Gary. It's a little bit chilly here in Lexington. Hope the weather is much better out there out west.
About 90 degrees right now, sorry.
Oh, my God. Rub it in, why don't you? Well, Gary, I can't say how excited I am for you and your recent comeback, and it's been a successful one. You just had your first winner this past Saturday, is that correct?
Yeah, I did, and, it's funny. They say, how many times is he going to do this, and blah, 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 and I went out to Bill Spar's barn on Saturday morning, a trainer I really, really respect, and it was an early 5:30 workout, and he said, look, I got another set to take out, be right back for some reading material on my desk. I got the racing forms there for today and tomorrow, which would be Sunday, and he said, really? He said, Steve Anderson, 0-2? You're 0-2 right now? And I'm like, no. And he said, yeah, he wrote about it. So thanks, Steve, on that. But luckily Saturday, I got it out of the way, I think, on my sixth or seventh bounce back. So that's always a heavy load off. First one back, the toughest one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that has to be such a good feeling. And you said in the beginning when news was released that you're going to get your hip replaced, you kept saying, you know, this is not my retirement. But to prove to everyone, you know, you're back and you won, that has to be a really good feeling.
Yeah, I think the best feeling was the way that I felt coming down the stretch. Even on my first mount back, I came up about a half a length short, and I wanted that bad. It would have been a storybook start back, you know, but that very rarely happens. And I felt great. That first, I was winded when I came back, had to blow the cobwebs out a little bit. But the way I felt on that filly on Saturday, it was like I was 21 again. It was pretty cool.
Wow. And you said you were a little bit winded, but you really didn't take that much time off to recover. You had your hip replaced in December?
Yeah, December 21st, so it hasn't been quite 3 months yet. And, you know, I think a big advantage is the way that, you know, not only my hip, but my knee. I was fit when I was racing fit when I had it done, and I think that helps out a lot with the recovery. You know, the doctors made decisions, and when they decided that it was time for a new hip, I had a new one 5 days later, and it's pretty cool.
Wow! And what did they? Do you have a ceramic hip?
I have a ceramic hip socket, mm-hmm. and then the rest of it's all titanium. And the partner of Dr. Yoon, Santa Monica, St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, California, did the hip, or did the knee. His partner, Dr. Matta, he's sort of the hip and pelvis guru, and Dr. Yoon is the knee guru, and they've come up with a material that works as the soft tissue, and everything is measured to specs. I mean, it's a custom-made knee and a custom-made hip. So I look at the incision in the front of my hip. It's not anterior or posterior. It was an anterior incision that was made, and it's only 4 inches, and I look at the x-rays and I'm like, how'd they fit that thing in there? But they did it, and it feels great. It actually feels better than what I had felt the previous 6 months leading up to the replacement.
Well, Gary, I have been dying to get you here on the show, especially since your comeback, because I was telling your wife Angie, I guess it was actually 3 years ago yesterday was my anniversary of retiring myself, and I retired because of a hip replacement. And I have to say, you're much more determined than I, and probably crazier as well. But so I know exactly what you went through, and to come back in 3 months is incredible. And I know what it feels like as well, what you were going through before that, and the pain you were experiencing there. It's definitely not fun whenever your hips don't really work and you're trying to ride. That's not a good combination whatsoever. And sounds like you had the best doctors, and they have you all set up with a great new hip. And what was recovery like for you?
Nothing like the knee. And they had told me, they said, look, if you've gone through the knee replacement, and Dr. and Dr. had had conversations, and Dr. Yoon said, look, this guy's unique, and he recovered much quicker from the knee surgery. I was back riding. My first race back was Breeders' Cup Day of 2015. I wrote a race for Chad Brown. And it was right at 3 months. And when I, you know, they told me, I said, what is the recovery for this hip? And they said, look, if you went through the knee, this is going to be like a hangnail. You will be back riding competitively at 3 months. Not just getting on horses, but riding competitively. And and I didn't plan to beat what they had told me or anything. It just turned out that way. I was ready, and here we are. But when I came out of recovery in the hospital, I had the surgery done at 6:30. I was back in my room at 10:15 in the morning, and at 10:45, a young lady walked into the room with a walker, and she said, are you ready? And I was still a little bit groggy, and I said, for what? She said, you're going for a walk. And when I walked into the hospital that morning, my blood pressure was up. I was in a lot of pain, and when I took that first step getting out of the bed and bared weight on the hip, I just got this big smile on my face. Mm-hmm. The pain was gone, and And I said, I don't think I need this walker. They gave me a cane, and the next morning, one of the fellowship doctors that was in surgery, he said, Stevens, you've got that cane in the wrong hand. And I said, well, I don't think I really need it. And he said, well, give it to me and stride out. So I gave him the cane, and I started walking. They took me to two flights of stairs. I went up the stairs, and I was home and at home by 1 o'clock the following afternoon. And so it was pretty cool.
Wow. I'm amazed at that. That's incredible. I did use my walker, so that's insane. But so you're saying that the knee replacement was much more difficult than this hip replacement?
Yeah, it was very difficult. You know, I've had several friends, and I've done a couple of talks with people that are about to undergo hip surgery or knee surgery. And I just tell him, because my doctor, Dr. Yoon, was straightforward with me. He said, your first 3 weeks are going to be the worst 3 weeks of your life you've ever had with the pain. And he said, I don't want you in pain. And I was pretty heavily medicated for the first 3 weeks. And for those first 3 weeks, I thought, what did I do to myself? Why did I do this? I'm never going to ride again. And pretty much to the day I woke up on a morning, and the pain had gone away quite a bit, but it was a long road back, and I pushed myself, and both doctors gave me the confidence to push myself. I really had no restrictions, other than, you know, they didn't want me getting on the road on a bicycle or on a horse where something was going to run out in front of me and cause me to have a fall and cause a fracture or something like that. But they were on it, and I was very fortunate in the care that I've had and the technology that they have now. It's crazy.
It really is. Does either your knee or your hip, does it ever bother you while you're riding now, or it's just such a relief that they both feel better?
No, just total relief. And the only thing with the hip is the tendons and everything are, when I first started getting on horses, were like sort of guarding the joint as they had been prior to. And once the brain told the tendons and stuff, this thing doesn't hurt, you don't have to protect. They're still stretching out a little bit, and each day is even better than the day before. But my first day back getting on horses was probably about 10% of the pain I'd been feeling for the last 6 months, as compared to a lot of pain. And I just fought through it. So I don't know. It's amazing what they were able to do for me.
Most definitely. And do you still do any kind of physical therapy on top of obviously riding races and getting on horses in the morning? Do you yourself go to the gym or do anything in addition to working horses to help with those previous injuries?
I live in the mountains. I do a lot of hiking, a lot of walking. My cardio was good when I went in to have my surgery and stuff, and I have the luxury of the San Gabriel Mountains and Mount Wilson and some steep inclines of elevation that help my cardio. So I put a lot of miles in as far as walking besides just riding horses. But I was back on my Equisizer, my mechanical horse, 3 weeks after I had the surgery. It's a stationary, I'm sure you know what it is, mm-hmm. but the people out there listening don't know what it is. And mine's an antique. They're stationary, and it was one of the first ones ever made by Frankie Lovato, a good friend of mine in New York that makes the Equisizers. And this particular one I have, he's part of the family, man. He's brought me back from a lot of injuries and everything. And so Dr. Mattis said, yeah, get on that thing if you're comfortable. And so I just, I started up right away, getting my range of motion back and the muscles and my hind quarters and my back and my upper body were, you know, I never really lost a lot from the time that I had the surgery until, you know, starting the workouts again.
Gary, something I found very interesting when I was doing the research for this show was that you actually had hip problems as a kid, as a small child. And do you think that affected your recent hip issues now, or was that irrelevant?
Well, it actually did, but oddly enough, I had leg Perthes disease in my right hip. This is my left hip, and my right knee is the one that was replaced. And I think that probably just like horses, you know, my left hip and left leg had been the workhorse since I was 6 years old. My right hip, when Dr. Mata x-rayed both of them, he said, you had leg Perthes disease in this right hip. And I said, yeah. And he says, you look like you got a 23-year-old hip in there. And it was the opposite hip that went south on me. So I think just it covering for the right knee all those years, and then the leg Perthes disease when I was young, it just wore out.
Makes sense. It was overcompensating for the other one. Right. Now, I do not know what that is exactly, like Perthes disease you mentioned. What does that do? How does that affect your body?
Young children, actually Jill Baffert, Bob Baffert's wife, she had hip replacement a couple years ago, about the same time as I had the knee, and she had leg Perthes disease in her hip when she was young. And that's the hip that she had replaced, and it's a lack of blood supply to the ball joint in your hip, and it's one of the few bones in your body that, if caught young enough, diagnosed, that bone will they stabilize it, no weight bearing at all, and that bone dies and regenerates. It your body absorbs the dead bone, new bone, and I'm talking about the actual ball joint in your hip, and that's what happened to my right hip. And I thank God for my parents saw that I wasn't walking right, I wasn't running right, and they took me to a doctor in Boise, Idaho when I was 6 years old named Don Blickenstaff. I'll never forget his name. He was an orthopedic guy, and they were able to diagnose it and stabilize me with a full-length leg brace, non-weight-bearing for 18 months, and learned how to ride a bicycle, learned how to run and stuff with one leg, you know. And so
that had to be hard for a six-year-old kid to wear a brace and not to put any weight on that leg for 18 months. That had to be difficult for you, especially, I'm sure, by that age, you had already found horses, and God knows you're running around and everything little kids do. So that had to be difficult as a young kid.
I was a lot harder on my parents than it was me. It was a young age, and there was a lot of teasing. If you look at my first ruling in horse racing, it's for fighting in the jocks room, and I was teased a lot. They called me Ironside and a lot of different things, and I was teased, and I learned to stick up for myself through my big brothers, and I started fighting, and I liked to fight, and got in a lot of trouble in school because of that. And anyway, it toughened me up quite a bit, and thank God I had two big brothers that looked after me. But it was a lot tougher on my parents than it was on me, and I had a full recovery, and you know, they didn't know if I'd ever be able to play sports or anything, and I went on, and here we are, you know, a lot of years later.
Here we are. Jockey Gary Stevens joining me here on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Gary, and I am overwhelmed right now with how little time we have really to cover all of your career highlights and everything. So briefly, describe to us, you mentioned your parents, and they were involved in the industry. Briefly describe how you grew up and came to the racetrack and when you decided to actually become a jockey.
My mom actually is responsible for getting my father involved in horse racing. My mom was a rodeo queen, Caldwell, Idaho, and dad was a city boy, and they started dating in high school and married young. And my grandfather, Donald Cooper, he was a dairy farmer, but he had race horses that they would match race and Lap and Tap and this and that. And he actually educated my father into, being a good horseman. And my mother was a great horsewoman, and she still is. And so dad eventually started training horses full time. He started out with a hobby, and my older brother, Scott, who's still riding right now and doing unbelievable, he started riding when he was 14 years old. And he was making good money, and he had a lot of girls that liked to hang out with him and stuff, and Scott was my idol. And whatever he did, I wanted to do a little bit better, as younger brothers do. And I got to hang out and ride with my brother last Friday, which was pretty cool. It's been a lot of years since we'd ridden together, and he was my mentor, and he's still my coach. He's one of the few guys between he and Mike Smith that can critique me, and I can critique them, and we have an unbelievable relationship. But at the level we're at, Mike and I and even my brother, we're not going to get a lot of help out there from anybody.
Right.
If things are going poorly, but we help each other, you know, it's pretty cool.
Are you guys still competitive? When you mentioned you rode against each other on Friday, are you still very competitive with each other?
It was a mess on Friday. I rode one for Richard Mandela, and the filly I was on is extremely fast, and my brother was riding a filly actually for my nephew. The whole family's involved. My nephew Satchel, he's 19 years old, and he trains at Turf Paradise. He's got horses at Prairie Meadows during the summer, and he's doing extremely well. And Scott came over to ride for him, and his filly's fast. And so Richard, the filly I was on, first time I've ever got the instructions I got to ride this filly at Del Mar, Flavian Pratt is then riding the filly, and Chiquita, Chiquita, and he said, just pop the clutch and go. Well, that's not Richard Mandela. It's usually get him to relax and finish and blah, blah, blah. So I won honor at Del Mar. And on Friday, he said, same thing. He said, just pop the clutch and go. And so my brother and I, we hooked up. We went 21 flat, 43 off the hillside turf course and just killed each other.
No.
And I came back, and Richard had his arms crossed and pulled his sunglasses down. He said, I should have left some margin for some common sense. And I just started laughing. I said, it was kind of like one of those backyard pasture match races that Scott just had with me. But brought back a lot of memories. It was a lot of fun.
I'm sure it did. That's too funny. And still riding with your brother, that's great. And he's doing very well, you said. Give us an update on how's his career is going.
He was leading rider the last couple of years at Turf Paradise. And he's either leading rider right now or close to it. He just came off of a suspension, which he was kind of upset with at 56 years old. He goes, yeah, I didn't see, or 55, whatever he is. He said, I didn't deserve those days, he said. I go, yeah, right. But he's doing great. He's enjoying things. We have a lot of conversations together, and you know, people say, why are you still riding? And Scott's part of the reason that I'm still riding. He goes, what else are we going to do that we enjoy more than what we're doing right now that is so fulfilling, and we're still good at what we're doing. And I'm like, yeah, right. So that's why I'm still doing what I'm doing. There's nothing else I can think of that I would rather be doing as long as I'm not embarrassing myself.
That's it. That's it. And once you have that in your blood, you just, there's nothing like it. There is no feeling like, you know, that when you cross the wire in front, and I'm telling you this, you've done it on the most incredible horses in the past, you know, in the last several years. And describe
to a lot of decades.
Gary, describe to our audience, if you can, and I really can't put it into words, what that feeling's like.
It's impossible to put in the words. You know, when I won my first Kentucky Derby, I had never experienced anything like it, other than my children's births. But that's even different. It's an out-of-body experience, and I try and explain it to someone, and I really can't. The only people I can explain it to are jockeys that win their first Kentucky Derby. And they come in to the jockey's room, and they have this look in their eyes of what just happened. And you just look at them in the eyes and say, welcome to the club. they experience it. It's tough to define, but that's what keeps you coming back. If you take your first win and just amplify that a million times, the only problem is it doesn't last very long, that feeling, because you got to get up the next day and ride other horses, and you get humbled real quick, you know, and you keep searching for that feeling again, you know, and that's the best way I can explain it.
The game keeps you humble. It's definitely for sure. And Gary, we need to go to break now, so I can't believe how fast time is flying by. But folks, stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We're spending the hour with jockey Gary Stevens. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, Fifth Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Songbird and Beholder, and they're into the stretch, and here we go. Songbird, sit down. Beholder is alongside. Forever Unbridled is 2.5 lengths behind them. Furlong to run. Songbird. Expected power as they come to the mark.
together. And then came Forever Unbridled. The final time was 1 minute 49.20 seconds. I believe Beholder did it.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Gary Stevens. Gary, we just heard the replay of Beholder's victory, her last victory in the 2016 Breeders' Cup Distaff. What do you feel? What do you think when you hear that replay?
Satisfaction. I perhaps should have did what Rosie did and just retired right then. But it felt like there was something left, you know, and not ready. She's the best I've ever ridden, and it was the biggest thrill. It was, I wrote a book, a biography that came out, I think, in 2001, 2002, something like that, and it was called The Perfect Ride, and it was satirical, the title, because I'd never ridden what I felt was the perfect ride, and in the book, as close as I ever came was riding a victory gallop against Real Quiet in the triple in the Belmont, the last leg, and I felt like that was as close as I ever came to riding the perfect ride, but it wasn't exactly perfect. And you're always searching, you know. I mean, for that perfect ride. And that day, that was it. And it was coming down the stretch with my other brother from a different mother, Mike Smith, in mano a mano. And I tightened it up on Songbird coming into the stretch. And I thought, all right, you got hooked in the Alabama, but not like this before. See how you like this. And I tightened it up on Mike and Songbird on the fence, and Songbird loved it. I go, oh, crap, I shouldn't have did that. And, it was epic horse race and just the ultimate feeling. And I thought I won by a further margin than an eighth of an inch, you know. And I celebrated a little bit at the finish. And Donna Brothers, she was waiting in the backstretch. And she looked at Mike, and Mike shook his head no. She looked at me, and I smiled, and she said, Gary, it's close. And she was listening to the stewards feed and everything, and I kept hearing the crowd roaring because they were watching on the big screen and at the finish, and I'm like, oh man, did I win this thing? This is going to be embarrassing. And then Donna smiled at me, and she said, I just heard from the stewards, you won it. And it was the ultimate.
It was close. It was just, I get goosebumps listening to that. And what a way for Beholder to go. I mean, everyone was rooting for her, knowing that was her final race, and that was just I get goosebumps. And I would also argue that you have had many, many, many other perfect rides, but you know, for that to be in your mind the perfect ride, I mean, couldn't agree with you more on that, most definitely. And you said she's the nicest horse you've ever ridden.
Yeah, she's you know, the development that she went through when I was fortunate enough to get on her, you know, her 3-year-old season at the end of the year and beat fillies like Royal Delta, and then her race in the Pacific Classic, you know, in 2015 was epic, you know. And I don't know, we had a tough year going into the Breeders' Cup, you know, the Pacific Classic. And then I think that both Richard and I underestimated Stella Wynn the first time that we faced her. And it was a disappointing year leading up to it. And for Mr. Hughes and Spendthrift Farm and everything, I think that I know personally, I was disappointed in myself a little bit, and I think Richard Mandela, he was disappointed a little bit, but he's genius, man, and he tightened the screws at the right time. The end of the year goal was the Breeders' Cup distaff. And he got her there right, and he got her there against a filly that is exceptional in Songbird. She is the miniature version of the Holder. Well, she was. I don't think she is now. She's full grown, and she's a four-year-old, and I'm looking forward to seeing what she can do this year with the goals that they've set for her. But epic horse race and trained to the T by one of the greatest trainers I've ever ridden for, and it was just very, very satisfying to have the kind of summer that we had had, which was kind of subpar of what we were used to with Beholder, and we almost felt, I think I did, that we had let the filly down a little bit, and to finish off the year in her career like that was special, really special.
Well, and you must have such a strong connection with her. You rode her to so many victories over several years. And what was she like?
When I first started out getting on her, and there are so many people involved, she I wouldn't say she was temperamental. She's just tough, mm-hmm. tough to be around at certain times. And I'll never forget in 2015 when I won the distaff honor, and I'd won the classic the following day on Mucho Macho Man, and took my daughter down, Maddie, to be introduced to Mucho Macho Man the morning after the classic, and with Kathy Ritvo and Dean Reeves and the whole crew was down there, and from there we went to Richard's barn, and she was one that you just respected. Never trust her, respect her, and she was always in charge. Remind me a lot of Winning Colors when she was young. Very aggressive and sort of make them think they're the boss, and they were the boss. And I'd never been around her in the stall. I'm really superstitious, and both Winning Colors and Beholder, when they'd hear my voice, they would think it's game time and get a little bit aggressive. So anyway, it was the morning after the 2015 distaff, and Richard says to my daughter, he said, "Do you want to go feed her a bagel? She loves bagels and cream cheese." And he led her into the stall, and I'm thinking, she's going to rip her head off. And Beholder came over and put her head over her shoulder and licked her on the face and started eating this bagel. Well, I saw a new side of Beholder. She's the sweetest filly in the stall, but when she walked out of there, she turned into something different. When she walked out of her stall, she'd blow up about three sizes and just turned into a colt, which was scary.
Big difference there, eating her bagel. That's hilarious. That's adorable. You mentioned Winning Colors as well, so let's talk about her for a minute. Of course, won the 1988 Kentucky Derby aboard Winning Colors, the filly, and take us through that day. You described a little bit the feeling you get when you win your first Derby, and that has to be an incredible feeling. But describe to us a little bit your journey with Winning Colors.
It was an emotional, scary time for me, because I was writing everything pretty much for the coach, Wayne Lucas, one of my dearest friends, and Mr. Eugene Klein, who at the time had the San Diego Chargers, and a powerful man who they said was difficult to work for. And thank God for Gene Klein, man, because everybody was trying to bounce me off that filly. I'd never won a Derby. I was young, and every top jock in the country's agents were trying to bounce me off, even after I won the Santa Anita Derby, to ride her in the Kentucky Derby. And I remember a quote that I read in the San Diego Union Tribune, I believe, that Mr. Klein, he said, if she wins the Derby, it's going to be with Gary Stevens. If she gets beat in the Kentucky Derby, it's going to be with Gary Stevens. And it was loyalty that in those days that was to the max, you know. And we're talking about Cordero, Pinkai, Shoemaker. I mean, the guys that were just legendary. And here I was, I'd ridden, you know, a couple of Derbies and everything. And the great Colt 49er with Woody Stevens and Claiborne Farm and everything. It was, I wasn't supposed to win, you know, and she wasn't supposed to win. Genuine Risk had won it and Regret had won it. And nobody thought she could go a mile and a quarter. And Wayne told me, he said, don't let anybody think she can go a mile and a quarter. Maybe we can get loose on the lead. And I was out in the paddock and on Derby Day, and Wayne said, listen, he said, nurse her as far as you can. And when you hit the 3/8 pole, he said, hit the go button and open up an insurmountable lead. And we got it done. And that last 16th of a mile, that last, I don't know, 7 seconds, whatever it was. It wasn't the fastest last 16th ever, but it was the longest 7 seconds in my life. And when I said out-of-body experience, I thought about my grandfather who died when I was 7 years old, and Grandpa Cooper and my mom and dad and everything they had been through with the hip disease I had and putting up with me. I was a troublesome child. it was pretty cool. All that stuff went through my mind, in that I knew I was going to win the Derby, but I'm like, wow. So
we've had a couple guests here on the show, Gary, who have described riding the Derby, and when they turn for home, they say it's, you know, when you're riding day in, day out, you don't, and you're so focused when you're on the back of a horse riding, and you don't hear the crowd. But apparently, when you're riding in the Derby, it's a little bit different. What is that sound? And if you hear anything, maybe some people are different, but what is that experience when you turn for home and the crowd's roaring and the just the feeling, the atmosphere? What is it?
Well, that last 7 seconds were the quietest 7 seconds of my life. There were, I think, 125,000 plus people there that day, and I shouldn't have really heard anything, but I could hear her breath.
And Gary, we've talked about Beholder and Winning Colors. Who else would make your top? Well, who would make your top three? I should ask.
Oh, man, you put me in a spot, because I've ridden so many good turf horses, so many. One horse that everybody never got the recognition he ever should have got was In Excess, who was he maybe should have been Horse of the Year. I don't remember what year it was. He winds up being the sire of Indian Charlie, who is the sire of Uncle Mo, and we all know what Uncle Mo is doing now. And In Excess, he came from Europe, and I actually won the first time on him on the dirt, I mean on the turf, and then we moved him. He won the Met Mile. I won the Whitney on him. He won the Santa Anita Handicap. He was a freak, and nobody even mentions him, but he was super special, man. And Farm Away, Bertrando, and then there was Golden Pheasant, who I won, you know, the Japan Cup on, first time I'd traveled over there to Japan, and I won the Japan Cup on him. And I don't know, I don't like comparing, and there was a lot of good ones. There's, and hopefully there's a few good ones to come. But,
absolutely.
It's just tough to say. I look through the list of grade ones and stuff of horses that I won on. I mean, I rode Precisionist. I rode Turco Man. What a year that was. Skywalker won the classic that year. I was on Precisionist, and Turco Man was second that year. And I've won the Marlboro Cup on Turco Man. And, you know, it's, just some really good horses over the years, and some super fillies. One filly, another one that, unfortunately, she never really came up with a lot of babies that could run, but they wound up being good broodmare sires, and that was Silver Bullet Day. I rate her right up with Serena's Song and Winning Colors and Beholder. She's definitely, Silver Bullet Day is in my top four of the best fillies I ever rode. When I won the Kentucky Oaks Honor and the year before the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Filly at Churchill Downs, both of those races, I don't think that other than Point Given that I ever felt so controlled of a race in a grade one as I did on those two occasions on that filly. And then most of the time when I rode Point Given, I hadn't even mentioned him, and I think he's the best horse never ever to win a Triple Crown. Whatever happened on that day, there's, you know, a lot of, I blame myself and Bob blames himself and he tells me not to worry about it, but he's the best horse never to win a Triple Crown, and he wound up really not getting a shot in the breeding shed.
Yeah, he didn't so much, but my God, Gary, you're giving out all these names, and I tell you, I printed out a list, 31 pages of graded stakes, so however many that was. I didn't stop to count because I would have been there for a very long time counting them all, but my God, and you mentioned Point Given, the greatest horse never to have won a Triple Crown. Let's talk about that briefly. You destroyed Real Quiet's attempt at a Triple Crown. And what was that like?
I'll tell you, it was bittersweet because, you know, the year before I got beat in the Belmont by Touch Gold, beat me on Silver Charm with Chris McCarron, a great ride by Chris McCarron. And I was devastated. I just devastated. Mm. I was following. I can remember it like yesterday. I came into the stretch. He was second to me in the. He won the Santa Anita Derby. He was second to me in the Preakness. Anyhow, when he came in, I had my sight. I'll think of it as I'm talking. I'm having a 54-year-old moment right now, but came into the stretch and I hit the eighth pole and it says, man, we're going to win a Triple Crown. And I knew not to get there too early. And I got there too early and I saw the shadow coming on the outside of me at the 16th pole, because the way the sun shines at Belmont Park at that time of the year through the stretch, the shadow of the horse is cast in front of the actual horse. And I saw the shadow coming out in like the five path. And that shadow actually passed me. And a lot of the people said, well, Stevens never saw him coming. Believe me, I saw the shadow before Touch Gold ever got there. And Chris had moved him out knowing that Silver Charm loved to fight. And he passed me. And he won by three quarters of a length. And when we hit the wire, Silver Charm galloped out in front. So a year later, I'm put on Victory Gallop in the Preakness. And Elliot Walden thought that Alex Solis had him too close, too far back in the Derby. And he ran a great race. And Alex, great friend of mine and everything, but you do what you're hired to do a job for. And Elliot told me, he said, try and keep him close to the pace today. I think Alex had him too far back. Well, I kept him close. And when Real Quiet made the lead, he started eyeballing the crowd. He was wandering all over the racetrack, and I didn't have any horse to come back by him. And I came back, and I said, Elliot, I can beat this horse in the Belmont. I said, but I got to ride him like Alex rode him in the Derby. And he goes, really? And I said, yeah, just drop back and make one run if things go right. And sure enough, Real Quiet made the lead early and started wandering around. And I saw him pulling up. And I didn't know. I said, at the quarter pole, I said, well, I might run third. At the 8th pole, I said I might run second. And at the 16th pole, I said I can win this thing. Hmm. And I'm really close friends with Mike Pagram, who owned Real Quiet. And, you know, he actually gave me a ride to the hotel the night before the Belmont Stakes. And I got out of the limousine, and there was Elliot Walden, stood on crutches. And he looked at me and goes, really? And I said, don't worry, boss. We got things covered. But, I know what that felt like. It was a $5 million bonus. The Visa Triple Crown thing had a $5 million bonus at that time.
That's right.
So it was bittersweet.
It had to, and it had to bring back memories because you knew exactly what that felt like.
Yeah, I felt bad for all the connections on the other side of the team. I was ecstatic, obviously, that I had won, but I knew what they were going through, but I had a job to do, and I went out and did it, and did it as good as you can do it that day, on that particular day, but I knew what they were going through.
Now, let me ask you this. Whenever we have a potential Triple Crown winner going up to the Belmont, and this has happened many, many times in the last several years, and there's an upset, and you always feel like their victory is kind of, you know, half lived, I suppose, because the crowd is they're all disappointed, and everyone's disappointed, but they're happy because obviously they just won the Belmont. But was it similar for you that day? Maybe did you get just that sense from the crowd that they weren't really as happy for you as you would have liked for them to be?
Well, they weren't excited about it at all. And on that particular day, Kent actually came out and bumped me. And I won by this. It was about as far as margin as Beholder and mm-hmm. Songbird. It mm-hmm. was extremely close. There was a long photo, but I had claimed foul when we pulled up, and the inquiry sign was flashing, and I'm thinking, please God, let me have won this race, because they're going to burn down Belmont Park if he beat me in the photo and they disqualify him. They're going to burn this place down. So I'm like, but it's weird racing against a horse that's going for a Triple Crown, because I been in that situation being the rider, and then I've been on the other end, and every rider, and when I was riding Silver Charm, you know, every rider in the race came up, including Chris McCarron, and he said, Godspeed, man. Hope you can win it unless I beat you. So we're all rooting for it too, you know, and to see American Pharoah do it. That was epic. I remember in was 2014 with California Chrome, mm-hmm. or 2014, yeah. And my brother had come in to Scott had come in to ride the mile and a half race on the dirt. I think the Brooklyn and we were in there, and they had all the saddle towels laid out. And the jockeys that were in there with their cell phones, and they were taking pictures of California Chrome's saddle cloth right before it went out. It's pretty cool.
And then finally, yeah. Like you said, we finally had a Triple Crown winner with American Pharoah, and so good for our sport. We needed that. And do you see that? Do you see any kind of potential Triple Crown winners coming up this year, Gary?
I'm not going to make any predictions. I loved Mastery.
Yeah.
I loved what I was seeing. I'm out at the track every morning. I whether I'm working or not, I watch him work. I watched Arrowgate work the other morning. What a gift he is for our sport right now. And, you know, to see him do what he did on Saturday and have it over with in less than 20 seconds, you know, and I watched him gallop out, and I was stood with my valet in the jocks room, and it was actually the race before I won my first race back, and I said, oh, this is not good. And then Mike jumped off of him. And so I saw it happening, and I go, there goes that. You know, but it's so difficult. No, I'm not brave enough to make any predictions on when the next one will be. American Pharoah, he was special. I think that we've got something exceptionally special with Arrowgate right now. You know, and to have the Prince, Khaled Abdullah involved there and just racing for the sport of it right now is great for our sport. So fun to watch.
Most definitely. Gary, we only have about 30 seconds, but lots to look forward to in our sport. What are you specifically, what are you looking forward to in the future of your career?
A Derby horse.
Derby horse?
And something, and something for the Breeders' Cup Classic. Yeah, I head to Oakland this weekend. I'm going to ride a couple horses back there. We'll see where that leads me, but I'm back on the map, so fingers crossed.
We are so happy to have you back, Gary. Wishing you all the best and just your recovery obviously is going so well. And you're just, when are you going to stop, Gary? No stop near in sight, I suppose.
I say this will be my last year, but if I've got a good two-year-old leading me into next year, I'll be back next year too.
Well, fingers crossed you got one of those, Gary. Wishing you all the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed.
Folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website at horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can listen to. And be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal. And thank you for listening.